All this of pot and potter, tell me then, who is the potter, pray, and who the pot? Omar Khayyam. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I hope you enjoy the show. If you're a returning listener, thank you for coming back. And if this is your first episode, welcome. I hope you'll enjoy it, too, and that you'll go back and listen to our backlog of episodes. So let's go ahead and dive on into this. This may end up being a shorter episode. I've had a lot of technical issues tonight. The Audacity, the program that I use to record, has been crashing on me quite frequently. I ended up just re-downloading the whole program. Hopefully that will fix the issues. I'm going to try and keep this, you know, at our standard length, you know, 30, 45 minutes or so. But it might end up being a little shorter than that. We'll just have to wait and see how things play out. But this week, we are finally ready to proceed into our coverage of the Levant from 6,000 to 4,000 BC. And I thank you for your indulgence for remaining back in Arabia an extra week, especially with a more kind of specialized or more esoteric topic like that. Now, we will probably be sticking in this region for a few weeks. I think at least three, maybe more than that. But we will be starting in the south and working our way north. And if you would like a refresher on what I consider the Levant, then I would recommend going back and listening to Season 2 and 3 for the same region. Apologies for the quick cut there. Sirens were going off in the background. So I went over in those prior seasons what I would include in this region then and there. Now, as for the term, I think I went over that in detail in Season 3, and I won't rehash it much more except to say that it entered into English around the 1490s from either Italian or French, and it was derived from one of those languages' words for rising. So it is usually thought to mean the land where the sun rises. Levant is related to the term leaven, like leavened bread. It is bread that rises. There you go. One of the big sites that we have talked about in relation to the southern Levant was Jericho, or as it's known today, or at least the archaeological site is known today, Tel es-Sultan, excuse me. So to briefly recap, this is a very ancient site. It was first occupied around 9000 BC, just a few hundred years after Göbekli Tepe first saw use. And it predates Çatalhöyük, a site some consider the first city, by over a millennium. Now, over the next 1,000 years, the site became fairly organized and more reliant on grown foods like wheat and barley rather than just pure hunting and gathering. They were also very early builders, prolific builders, compared to especially places like Çatalhöyük. These people did not build kind of that honeycomb, anthill-esque city. They opted for, you know, smaller domiciles, but with surrounded by stone walls. And these were very big stone walls. They were 3.6 meters high, which is like 12 feet, and they were about 1.8 meters, which is 6 feet wide at the base, at their deepest point. Why they built these was either for defense, flood protection, or animal/population control, controlling their movement. Or maybe some element of all three. They also constructed a stone tower for what exact purposes are debated. Some claim it was a watchtower. Others give it a kind of ceremonial or religious purpose, maybe both. And this was the tallest known structure in the world until the Egyptians started building pyramids. They were also appeared to worship their ancestors. They built statues of them, and in some cases are plastering their skulls and decorating them with seashells and stones and things like that. Now, at that point, where we were talking about Jericho in the past, there may have been as many as 3,000 people. Some think it was as few as 300. And some consider this to be the first city, though it doesn't get as much credit as Chatelhoyuk does in that regard. And again, all this stuff is baited. We've talked about what is a city in an episode prior. I recommend going back and listening to that. So, just... but I do want to just say that some people make the claim that this is actually the first city. Now, another few centuries pass by, and the site was possibly abandoned or just saw a massive population drop right around 7,800 BC, give or take 100 years, one way or the other, probably due to climate conditions, or it may have been some type of disease outbreak, you know, something that wouldn't necessarily show up in the archaeological record. Now, around 7,000 BC, there was a shift at the site, and it became occupied again, apparently brought about by migrants from groups to the north. There is still no pottery at that site, at that time frame, and they're not as successful as the earlier settlement in terms of building large stone structures, permanent things like that. But they do build some communal spaces, and possibly even a shrine. And they also continue skull cult-like rituals, but they have more variety in their carved figurines as well. They have not just human figures, but animal or human-Hannibal hybrid type things, or humans with animal-like characteristics. They are also able to rely more heavily on domesticates of all variety than the earlier group did. They also have more advanced tools and techniques for processing these resources. However, this lasts only to around 6,000 BC, where this season starts. After this time, Jericho is abandoned once again, either once more from climate issues, preventing enough food from being grown, or, again, possibly disease. And there isn't much evidence of human destruction at this lair or a natural disaster. So there's not an invasion or anything like that, at least that has left a mark on the site. Now, another 1,000 years passes, and we begin to see signs of a return of a possibly permanent population, though they are living much simpler lives than the people living here permanently had at the previous two attempts. They didn't build these larger communal buildings and things like that, but they did know how to create pottery, which is something neither of those two early groups seemed to know how to do. Now, it's extremely simplistic compared to their neighbors who know how to create pottery, but it is practical, and that seems to be these people's primary concern. The dwellings put up during this phase are also small and simple. And there seems to be no reliance on planned agriculture. It seems like animal herding became the primary means of survival of the population here at this time. And this was not a large population. In fact, there is some debate on whether or not this was even a permanent population at all. Some contend that this was just a site that was used as people were migrating through the area seasonally, or maybe they would stay for a year or two and then move on. Others claim that this population is just in line with other sites in this general area at around the same time period. They think the population was small because instead of opting into larger towns or proto-cities, they split themselves into smaller villages or pastoral bands. And this phase of Jericho is part of that larger trend you see in the region. However, this does change again, starting between 4,500 and 4,000 BC. Again, give or take a century, one way or the other, the entire southern portion of the Levant begins to see increasing signs of urbanization. There are smaller settlements, but they increase in size from villages to towns, and they become more organized and more, again, villages pop up as well. So, the previous villages generally grow into towns, and then more villages are established. Or maybe villages stay, but towns grow up nearby them because they're more suited to supporting a larger population. You also see the pottery from these areas begin to become more diverse, and there's a lot more local innovations on manufacture and style. In fact, there is even evidence that the potter's wheel was invented independently in the southern Levant, almost the exact same time as it is being invented in Mesopotamia. Now, it's always kind of difficult to talk about diffusion when it comes to ideas, culture, technology, things like that, especially when you look at older academic texts where, you know, such and such people are credited with inventing such and such. This type of thing is rarely that simple, though, and I think I've kind of expanded on this in previous episodes, but there are occasions where I do kind of fall into it too. But there are instances where something like this happened, but there are, and by that I mean there are instances where, yes, one group introduces a technology or an idea or tradition to another. That definitely happens. But there are many, or maybe even more, of people independently developing the same idea or a similar idea in technology. There are also the in-between cases of people starting to develop their own method when they meet someone with a more advanced version of the same idea, and then they either abandon their initial version and adopt the more advanced version, or they kind of integrate the two together in some way. Then, of course, you have situations where someone has an idea or product that's fine, but then in another reason said subject catches on to due to a number of factors different from where it originated. We talked about, I think, barley. Barley's kind of considered a lesser crop in a lot of the further Mediterranean-like regions, but in Northern Europe, it's more profitable. It grows better. It's a better choice, essentially. And I did talk about that in some of those domestication episodes earlier this season. So, again, recommend, if you haven't listened to those, go back and listen to them again. But when it comes to the innovation that is the potter's wheel, early examples are found in northern Mesopotamia and the southern Levant, again, dating to around the same time. Now, there are things that are passed from these cultures and civilizations, but as far as I can tell, this never happened directly. And by that, I mean that these things that spread between them had another area they reached first, the northern Levant, the area essentially just to the west where the Fertile Crescent region begins its bend. That's along the western portion of the modern Syria-Turkey border region, the place where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers form. So when you see an idea or item that developed in the southern Levant or Mesopotamia and it starts to spread out, it shows up in the northern Levant before spreading onto the other region. You don't see that with this. There's no example of this technology in the northern Levant at this season, at least that we've discovered so far. Now, you could conceivably see some groups travel directly between the southern Levant and Mesopotamia. The area directly between them today is mostly desert, but at this point, it was a lot greener than it is now. And, there are actually a decent amount of marshlands in kind of the southwest of Mesopotamia. And there still are some. There are still marshes in like southern Iraq, Kuwait area, and they were spread much further. But for large-scale migration and trade at this point in time is difficult, but between those two regions directly. Camels weren't domesticated in this region yet, and the domesticated donkey only spreads to Asia at the very, very tail end of this season at the earliest. It's still being domesticated in northern Africa, you know, this season. I think 4000 BC is kind of like the high water mark. Like 4000 BC directly is the earliest it would have begun to spread into Mesopotamia. And that's another thing, like this diffusion of ideas that we talk about, people, something spread very quickly, but actually most of this stuff takes, you know, decades, hundreds of years in some cases. We know that Egypt does not get the potter's wheel until like the 2900, 2800. And they pick it up from the southern Levant. They did not develop it on their own. So, you know, and they're right beside each other. And there's large-scale interactions between those people. This is just one piece of technology that just didn't spread for some reason. Part of that is part of the reason that I don't think it spread between the southern Levant and Mesopotamia. And I'll kind of go into that. But these are very simple wheels. When I talk about pottery wheels, you can't think of like the modern like pedal powered ones where you pump the pedal and it spins. No, these are very simplistic. These are in some cases just a stick stuck into a hole in the ground, and then a either very small stone with kind of like a hole kind of drilled in the middle or like scraped out in the middle that the stick kind of balances in, or it's another piece of clay or mud brick that has been shaped like a wheel or a square in some cases, and that has had the stick molded into it, and then it's hardened, and then they just spin it by hand and then work out the pottery in kind of these coils of clay. And then they'll just kind of spin them around manually or have someone else help them. Possibly that's how training is done. Like you have someone watch what you're doing while they're spinning, you're doing the work, and you're teaching someone that way. So it's probably not the easiest thing to transport. It's probably the clay base or wheel itself is probably very easy to break. It's probably not something that would travel well. It'd probably be a pain to carry too. So if you were traveling someplace, you'd probably just build your own if you knew how to do it. Now for why these people aren't moving, there's probably a couple of reasons. There's a lot of unoccupied land in these regions, so they don't have to go that far. Also, if you're a skilled craftsman, and this is a period of time with the emergence of urbanization, you begin to see individuals become specialists in certain types of labor, which again gives rise to specialized craftsmen. You're probably not having to worry about moving, especially if you're very good at making pottery or tools. You're probably highly sought after. You probably have some level of prestige in your community. And then again, with the rise of urbanization, you again see kind of this rise in social distinction and social classes. So that's another reason I don't think you'll see too much movement, at least for this type of people. And I'll try and remember to post the picture I found, but if you aren't following me on Twitter, you should if you have a Twitter account, because I do post pictures and things like that that I'm talking about. But I'll try to remember to post the map for this week where they've kind of clocked to where they found in Mesopotamia and in the southern Levant where they have found these kind of rudimentary potter's wheels. And there is just huge chunks just in both of Mesopotamia and in the Levant. And then there's that big kind of bend in the middle between them in like the northern Levant / southern Anatolia where there is just nothing. It's very wild to see. Also wanted to talk about that because pottery making is one of the things that really stands out in this period. It becomes one of the ways that people are able to identify new groups or emergent groups of people, much like the way, you know, different tool types and things like that have been used in the past. Tools are still important for this kind of thing, but now you have another set of data to kind of compare and contrast people to. And that kind of leads me to another thing I wanted to mention. I haven't really brought it up too much this season because I haven't really been able to get firm numbers. But I did read one paper, and it's an older one. I think it was the mid-80s, and it was in French, so I may have had some trouble translating it. But the population after, and this is worldwide, the human population, there was a massive population growth. Hunter-gatherer populations, tend to double fairly steadily. Even with, some groups probably being in areas may not support the population, once you switch to agriculture, there is an uptick in the population. Even if all of these groups are not necessarily practicing full-scale sedentary agriculture, especially in an urban setting. Cities are not humans' primary living space until much, much later. In fact, that's within living memory. So you're still having the majority of your population living in smaller groups, cities, or van cities, villages, towns, and again, small, like related bands, clans, whatever you want to call them. But around 5000 BC, I think there were worldwide maybe around 40 million people. Now, this is kind of a period where that population stabilizes. People have begun to adopt to a more agriculture-based diet. I've mentioned it before, but the first few generations of people who are relying solely on agriculture as their primary food source, they're not in the best shape. Their stature diminishes, their teeth are a mess, their bone density is not great. They're not in the best of health. Plus, like, the work they're doing to maintain these agricultural fields is very, very rough on the body. And that doesn't change. That remains the same for quite a while. But the food source is steady, is the thing. So the population is still able to grow. So after an explosion at the start of the Neolithic Revolution, population stabilizes, and then it starts growing steadily again as more and more agricultural groups expand, take more territory, and eventually form city-states, kingdoms, empires, and all that stuff. Even with all the war and other stuff, the population is steadily growing from 5000 BC onward. Let me find that article again. I just want to make sure. Yeah, it's Jean-Noël Birabin. And it's Essai sur l'évolution du nombre des hommes, population. And again, it's in French. That was 1979. Wow. I'm surprised that no one's done a more recent one. Maybe that they've kind of accepted that his numbers were accurate. I don't know. but yes, so that is kind of where the human population is at this time. And again, that's worldwide. That is not in just one continent. Now, for the Southern Levant, we've talked already about how there were numerous smaller settlements, towns, and villages. And we'll see when we get into the historical period that the Southern Levant especially is home to a number of different smaller kingdoms, city-states, what have you. Some are territorial, maybe with a capital city and a few towns and villages that are kind of supportive of said city-state. And then there are some that are, city-states in their traditional sense, in the more Greek sense, where they control just the city itself and maybe a few miles in one direction. And we know from the Bible Assyrian records, Egyptian records, Mesopotamian records, that there are several states all very close to each other on the Levantine coast at this earlier period. And it's not just settled societies either. There are numerous mobile groups kind of in between them that are maybe more pastoral than agricultural based. And in the grand scheme of things, these are not huge territories. But in some cases, they're able to get a large enough population to field, in some cases, 10, 20,000 soldiers. And, you know, all their attendant baggage train, slaves, servants, that kind of thing. And that's, again, just the smaller states. The larger ones, the more powerful ones, the richer ones, can even do more than that. But, yeah, and just in the southern Levant, I know during the kind of during the biblical period, or at least part of the biblical period, I can think of at least 7 or 8 kingdoms and tribes, all just in and around the Dead Sea, that, you know, that are in kind of this area that we're talking about just on its own. Now, in terms of connections, it does appear that Egypt is a big cultural influence on the southern portion of the Levant, whereas the northern portion of the Levant is also influenced by Egypt, but they also have ties to Anatolians and Mesopotamian states as well. But again, this is kind of looking forward a little too much, so I'm going to kind of refocus here and go back to more in this season's purview. But I did want to say that, you know, this region does have a number of resources and can support a number of different groups. Who is living here at this time is kind of hard to say. Some of the DNA is kind of hit or miss, but obviously there have been groups that have been moving back and forth between Lower Egypt. There have been groups coming from Anatolia or from down the kind of the Fertile Crescent region from Mesopotamia. And there are, again, at least, I would say at least 4 different groups that are making up this population. Now, how much they know of this past is obviously not known. We also know that when we get to the historical period, there are going to be a few different groups speaking a variety of Semitic. We talked in our first Arabia episode how the Semitic languages come about. We talked about the Eastern and Western Semitic split. Whether that's happening this season, it's hard to say. At the very least, I think the foundations for the Eastern and Western Semitic languages split is probably taking place at this period. The Western group, which does include Arabic, will, again, kind of be in the south and kind of north, to the south of this region, maybe around the Sinai Peninsula, too. It's kind of hard to say. But the western branch is going to split into is going to split again, and this is going to give rise to more languages. So I think there is a component of Central Semitic-speaking peoples that are in the southern Levant at this period, or they're moving into this region at this period. Who knows, it could be their migrations that kind of lead to this population buildup. There are probably other Afro-Asiatic-speaking peoples, again, maybe speaking that original Afro-Asiatic tongue or an evolved version, a regional version of Afro-Asiatic. There are groups moving down from the north and from the northeast as well. Of course, by the time we get to the historical period, most of the people in the Levant are speaking some form of Semitic, at least the southern Levant. Western Semitic divides again. You've got the Central Semitic peoples, which will be the Canaanite languages, the Amorite, Hebrew, all of those are part of that. And then, of course, Arabian kind of makes up its own branch off of the Western Semitic. And there are other subdivisions, too, that we'll talk about. They have gone extinct today, however. There are no versions of those branches from the Western Semitic. But that's all in the future that we'll talk about. Now, in terms of large-scale travel and trade, again, I've already talked about the links to Egypt. But essentially, there are three routes through the Southern Levant that people can take by land. You can go directly along the coast. This would be leaving Sinai. You'd go through what is today Gaza, and then all along the coast, essentially straight to Anatolia. One of the big stopping points is the city of Byblos, which is in modern-day Lebanon. It's today known as Jabil or Jubail. I'm not sure how that's exactly pronounced. But this is a very early city, and it's been inhabited since 5000 BC. And we'll be talking more about that city, I think, next week. It's either next week or the week after. Then you also have, instead of going through the coastal route, you have a route through the hills. And this would take you to more interior cities, and this would lead you to what is today Damascus. And Kadesh, which is another city that we will be talking about. And then there's another highway, and this connect will eventually go all the way to what is now southern Arabia and Yemen. And this will also go through from those places in the south to Damascus in the north. But there's a few different pathways through there. In terms of land routes to Mesopotamia, there's only two that I'm aware of. And these don't come about until a little bit later. Again, partly due to desification of the region. And I'm not aware that, again, that there's any large-scale trade. There is some, but it doesn't pick up until later periods. So, again, to get there, you kind of have to go north and then east to get there. But it shows why this place is so important in terms of travel, and why another reason why there are so many states and peoples that spring up in the area, because it is so vital in terms of travel and trade, not to mention, you know, just controlling the resources in the area to survive. So you control the trade routes, you make sure, you know, who comes through, who's giving you what for passage, or you're accepting the goods and then carrying them on yourselves. So that is another thing that draws people into this area. It's not just how fertile the land is or isn't, or how much cattle or sheep or goats that you can raise there. It is the location, as it were, that is also important. Now, another big thing that's happening this season, we've talked in the past about how, you know, there's the praise Neolithic, pre-pottery Neolithic, the A, B, and C phases of said pre-pottery Neolithic, and how all of these groups are in some cases overlapping with each other. There are some groups that are in the Neolithic phase. There's some that's in the pre-pottery phase. There's some that are in pottery phases. Another phase that's coming about in terms of material cultures is copper, the Chalcolithic phase. And we talked about that in our metallurgy special. The Southern Levant is home to a couple of different sources of copper, which is, of course, vital to being in the copper age, but it will also be important once bronze is discovered and how to smelt it and alloy copper with tin and other metals to create bronze. And there are going to be a couple of chalcolithic cultures arising in the southern Levant. These are known as the Beersheba culture and the Gasulian culture. And I think I'm going to go ahead and say that we'll talk about them next week. There are a few different things I want to get into when talking about these peoples, but there are some other things I want to do as well. And I think focusing on material cultures all in one episode might be the way to go. I've kind of jumped back and forth on a couple of different topics about the region and what's drawing people here. And did want to follow up with Jericho. Now, I did say that Jericho is reoccupied at this stage, but also starting after this stage, the site is going to be abandoned a couple of more times. In these cases, though, I believe most of these are attributed to human destruction. It seems people are very jealous of the people living in Tell es-Sultan. It's been attacked several times, abandoned for periods, and then reoccupied by different groups. Eventually it will have another long-term establishment of a Bronze Age city there. That's the one that most people are familiar with from the Bible. We'll get into that next week. Thank you all for joining me. I hope you've liked my rambling a little for this week. If you have any questions or feedback, constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach out to me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can talk to me via direct message on Twitter/X. I do recommend you following me there. I do post pictures and stuff occasionally. Of things I've been talking about. You can also send me an email, as I said, again, at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can comment on the YouTube videos. I do go back and read the comments, though if you comment on an earlier episode, I may not see it for a little while, and I don't check it constantly for newer episodes, except maybe day of. So sooner you comment there, the better. Also, live stream on YouTube. I play history, kind of war strategy games, things like that. You're welcome to subscribe on YouTube and join me when I'm live and talk in the chat there. I love hearing from listeners when they drop in, so please do. Thank you all for joining me this week. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope you have a good rest of your day and or week when you listen to this. And I'll see everyone next time. Have a good one. Peace.